please stand by. Ready to start. Our next two guests probably need no introduction to most of you, but I'll give one anyway. To my far left, Dennis Rooney is an audio producer and audio archival consultant and a record collector since the age of 9. He is also a writer on musical subjects for various magazines, including The Strad, of which he is the North American editor. Dennis is a member of the ARSC Technical Committee. And to my immediate left, Seth Winter is an audio engineer at the Rodgers and Hammerstein Archives of Recorded Sound in New York City and proprietor of Seth B. Winter Sound Studios Incorporated. His transfer work has appeared on numerous labels, including BMG Classic, Sony Classical, MCA GRP, Pearl and Opal, the Metropolitan Opera, and the New York Philharmonic. He is co-chair of the ARSC Technical Committee along with, I forget his name.
The
title of their presentation is Retrieving and Restoring Information from Damaged Full-Track Monaural Tape Recordings. Seth Winter and Dennis Rooney.
Thank you very much, Gary. Good afternoon. I see that the sun is beginning to set on our presentation, but I take that as a good rather than an ill omen. I'm here today with Seth to share some insights about reproducing full-track tapes, because for the past year we have been working with a large quantity of such tapes in conjunction with a multi-CD set of historical commercial and broadcast recordings made by the Minneapolis Symphony Orchestra and its successor, the Minnesota Orchestra, between 1924 and 2000. This set will be part of the orchestra's centennial celebrations, which begin this autumn when this CD collection will go on sale. Our work together has enabled us to pool much practical information that we've each acquired in dealing with such tapes. As will be demonstrated by the audio examples we will play later, our current project will benefit materially from some playback strategies that Seth has developed over the past several years. Most audio master recordings made in the period from the late 1940s until the general demise of analog recording in the late 1980s are longitudinal magnetic recordings made at a tape speed of 15 inches per second. Various track configurations were employed during that time: quarter-inch tape with one or two tracks, and half-inch tape with three or four tracks, but their common feature is the use of wide magnetic tracks on the tape. In the early period of magnetic recording, the accompanying electronic circuit technology was fairly primitive with respect to the amplification of very small signals. The electrical signal produced by a playback head is quite small, having a maximum value of several millivolts. The playback head is a transducer, which is, in effect, the secondary circuit of a transformer where the magnetic flux is due not to a primary winding, but rather to the passage of stored flux on the tape across a gap in the magnetic core of the head. It follows that more flux passing the gap will produce a larger output voltage. Since the fluxivity, expressed in Weber's per meter, of the tape cannot be arbitrarily increased due to saturation of the magnetic material on it, the track and gap must be made wider so that more magnetic material is seen by the gap. Please look at figure A of the illustration, which has just been lighted. The width of the gap is in the same direction as the width of the tape. The length of the gap is measured in the direction of tape travel. Doubling the track width also increases the intrinsic noise due to the tape area. Because the noise is random, it increases as the square root of the track width, 1.414 or 3 decibels. The signal is coherent and increases linearly with track width, 2 or 6 decibels. Therefore, each doubling of the track width improved the inherent signal-to-noise ratio by 3 decibels. But the increased electrical output also improved the signal-to-noise ratio in the reproduced preamplifier by 6 decibels. At the time, the overall improvement obtained by a full-track configuration was decidedly worthwhile. However, the wide track carries a penalty that increases with time. illustrated by figures B, C, and D. Figure B shows a perfect gap perfectly aligned. This requirement for perfect straightness of the gap and perfect alignment with respect to the tape exists for both the record and playback processes. If everything is perfect, then the magnetic signal on the tape is at any instant equal all along the width of the gap, and so is coherent. All instances of flux across the length of the gap are additive, and the signal is recorded and reproduced correctly. Figure C shows a perfect gap, but misaligned with respect to the tape. This defect could occur in either recording or playback. If it occurred in the recording, then the playback head, with a perfect gap, must be intentionally misaligned to match the misalignment of the recording head. Figure D shows an imperfect gap for which no exact alignment is possible. While the drawing is grossly exaggerated for illustrative purposes, this was in fact a common defect in wide-track systems. To give some understanding of the dimensions involved, note that figures C and D denote a time error. Assuming a tape speed of 15 inches per second, one full wavelength of a 10 kilohertz signal occupies 0.0015 inches, or 38 micrometers, along the direction of travel. Referring to figure C and assuming a gap and track width of 1/4 inch, an azimuth error of 0.172 degree will displace the top and bottom ends of the gap by 0.00075 inches, or 19 micrometers, which is a half wavelength at 10 kilohertz. The result will be an almost complete cancellation of the output, because part of the gap will be reading tape flux, which is 180 degrees out of phase with the other. And at this point, I wish to thank my good friend Mike Shields of DMS Electrotechnology Consulting for supplying those illustrations in front of us, as well as helping with some of the preceding technical exposition. The aspect of this problem that, as I mentioned earlier, becomes worse over time is that improperly wound tapes can experience mechanical deformation, which is dimensionally comparable to head defects or worse. This is especially true along the edges of the tape and is particularly troublesome with acetate tape, the industry standard from the late 40s to the mid-60s. Many consumers continued to prefer acetate to polyester tape because of acetate tape's tendency to break cleanly rather than stretch. But a reel of acetate tape did not often pack properly when fast wound. And if such a fast wounded reel was put into storage with a poor pack, where the edges were unevenly spaced or where the entire wind was warped, regardless of a smooth pack, those deformations usually became permanent, as the example we have placed up here on the table will graphically show. And there are some further illustrations of problems which are on the slides that I would like to run right now. And Seth, perhaps you can describe in detail some of these phenomena.
Some of these things you may have remembered when I did talked about the Toscanini legacy about 10, 11 years ago, but they are still apropos to our talk today. On the left is an acetate-based tape out of Legacy that was properly packed, but as you will notice, there are slots. There's a slot on the hub, which causes a deformation. To the right is the preservation copy that was made at the library on a new set of flanges with a slotless hub. Let us see what happens next. This is an example, if you could see it, of a tape that actually was tight wound but has a very poor pack to it. And slightly to the left, in the upper left-hand corner, you see a little white streak. That's the splicing tape that has oozed, that was used at the time to create a splice.
I'll talk about that more later.
This is what we use. This is a more exaggerated form of it I have up here. But this is essentially what happens to acetate-based tape that's been poorly wound, fast wound onto reel and left for 10, 20, 30 years. Here's another form of it, where it looks like part of it was partly wound and then fast forwarded through another section and then partly wound properly and then fast forwarded into the inside. Oops, come on. This is also something a lot of engineers did. They didn't put the flanges on. You're looking at a hub, what's called a pancake. It's properly wound, but even within that, you could see the two slots. In other words, there was a slot on either side of the reel to make it easy to reel the tape in quickly so you could start running the recording. Where those slots are will cause a certain amount of what is called fluting or deformation, because remember, the greatest amount of tension or pressure on the tape is on the inside because it keeps wrapping on itself. This is why by the late 60s, early 70s, they stopped using these slotted hubs and went to an NAB standard. This is another example of a tape, acetate tape in a box that hasn't been tacked down, and you can see how it's unraveling. This is another thing where people say, don't tack it down, don't tack it down, don't use anything. Sorry. Take a look at what's happening there. All right, let's see. Ah, yes.
Hold that for now.
Right.
The worst such effects of bad acetate tape packs can often be ameliorated by a reverse winding onto a slotless hub on which the tape is wound oxide out, which is sometimes known as a B wind. Such a maneuver will often improve the pack dramatically. If left undisturbed for at least 1 month and preferably 6 months or longer, the tape will exhibit far less deformation when played back with a conventional wind. We have a reel of acetate tape that has been rewound to produce a smooth pack suitable for long-term storage sitting, well, here it is, right in Seth's hand.
Well, you can come up and look at it, but you could probably see the difference of one that has been left like this for like 40-odd years, and this is one properly packed, NAB hub, proper flanges, tacked down.
A combination of deformed tape, a crooked or misaligned recording head or playback head, and a wide playback track may make it effectively impossible to accurately recover any signals above a few kilohertz. Worse yet, the inaccuracy may take the form of swishy or phasey sounding treble about which nothing can be done. And we can show that on the transparency, which will be up next. Seth?
Nothing like an analog drawing to show something really analog. What you're looking at here is essentially four different tape head playback configurations that are available for quarter-inch tape. The red lines on top are essentially the tape path. The blue line on top and bottom would essentially be the effect of edge curl damage on a tape, which would be shown at the bottom here of the poor head contact. Side view. In other words, where the tape just doesn't hit anywhere on the top and bottom. Now, it's quite obvious from what you're seeing that the only spot of the tape that really makes good head contact is pretty much through the center.
And just because the recorded track is wide, there is no law which says that its entire width must be read. With current reproducer technology, adequate signal-to-noise ratio can be accomplished with fairly narrow playback track width. For example, assume a quarter-inch full-track tape needs to be recovered. If a quarter-inch four-channel head is used in the playback machine with suitable switching, there are four chances to find a good section along the width of the track, and usually the best will be near the center. With an adjustable height head mounting, it would be further possible to tune in the best part of the original wide track. On stereo quarter-inch tapes with edge damage, using the inner tracks of a four-track head may completely circumvent the difficulty. Two different head assemblies of this type are on the table, and Seth can show us something more about each one.
Alrighty. Well, essentially, as you see in the diagram, when you have edge curl damage, The only two that are really suitable for playback would be the last two, the quarter track, which was the consumer use mounting, which is a figuration of tracks 1 and 3. And then when you got to the end of the tape, you flipped over and it became essentially tracks 2 and 4, which was called quarter track or four track record playback, or what was called a quad head, which has all four channels lined up in the same direction. What I have here is I went to JRF Electronics and I said, told John French, I want a playback assembly that has a full track head in it, two track stereo, and a quad head with only channels 2 and 3 attached, which then fits into any of the standard Atari 5050 series machines. And what happened is I did a number of experiments, and on tapes such as what you see up here, with very bad scalloping, we got some quite remarkable results. And these are up here for display, that you can actually see the head, the quad head in place. And this is actually the ones we used for the playback of the demonstration we're going to hear in a little bit.
Now, with the use of narrower tracks to play back a full track tape, an interesting problem comes along, an error in the low frequencies due to flux fringing. This is because at long wavelengths, that is at low frequencies, the ends of the gap will see the flux beyond the width of the playback track. This results in an increased low frequency response. And while this fringing error is easily corrected with equalization, it should be noted that there is a special problem with tapes using noise reduction encoding. All companders, whether Dolby, DBX, or EMT, have the property of magnifying frequency response errors which are introduced between the encoder and the decoder. So the excessive bass due to fringing becomes more excessive after noise reduction decoding. It is probably best to introduce the equalizer between the playback machine and the noise reduction decoder. Since there is no objective method to compensate the error, it must be done by careful listening. Some quantification of the error can be made, however, by playing a full track alignment tape and adjusting the external equalizer for flattest low frequency response. This may not be exact, however, because of other low frequency errors in the original recorder. The tape deformation imperfect gap azimuth error family of problems is very basic. If the initial playback of the tape is flawed by the mechanisms discussed, all subsequent restoration operations may be fruitless. Hear that, all you people out there making preservation copies? Only one operation must precede the solution of this problem when dealing with tapes of this type and vintage. Acetate tape has one feature of significant help to the conservator and restorer. It is translucent when viewed against a bright light. Would you demonstrate, please?
Oh, whichever one.
You'll be able to see some of it.
Thank you.
Put it on the wall.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yes.
Yeah, you can't do any more to that tape than has not already been done. There you go. Oh no, that's a complete loser. All right. Bravo.
No, you hold one, I'll hold the other. Now, just to show you, this is the perfectly packed reel. So round, so firm, so
fully packed, so free and easy, yes. All right. In addition to spoking or other evidence of an imperfect wind, any splices will be easily seen. In the case of splices, we can't fail to mention that many acetate tapes of the 50s, especially the period from 1953 to 55, are afflicted with bleeding splices due to the behavior of the adhesive on the splicing tape sold by 3M, which was then the largest supplier of it, and I think still is.
No. They are out of business. It's pretty much Agfa now.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that. Well, unlike any, and unlike other old 3M adhesive splices, where the adhesive is usually likely to dry out over time, the tackiness of the adhesive in this batch imperils the oxide surface of the tape when fast wound. A tape with such splices must be carefully and slowly wound to identify spliced points in the length. And as these approach, the entire splice should be soaked with a mixture of heptane, also known as naphtha, and isopropyl alcohol, so that the adhesive is dissolved as the splice comes off the supply reel. Such a practice ensures that the adhesive will not take any oxide with it from adjacent layers. And the following slides show how to deal with such a splice.
Okay. There's the using splice. Wound down to exactly to the, in other words, the tape was wound down to the point of where the splice is.
What about the wind right before?
Ah, yes, I will get to that.
I mean, you should have stopped that before.
Pardon?
Pardon me?
You should stop.
I know that.
You couldn't have seen it.
It's very difficult to get it, but what would happen is you have to remember that the wrap that's right above that, when that comes off, many a times the oozed glue will rip a little bit of the oxide at the edge on the top and bottom, as well as a little bit going down vertically. You know, it's replicating the shape of that splice and length. All the more reason why you need to use some sort of playback head so that when it goes by, if you use the full track head across that, you get a dropout because you're missing the top and bottom area of that adjacent oxide that has just been ripped off. Whereas with that four-track assembly, using the two center tracks, you miss that edge oxide that is gone. All right. What do we got next? That's a little bit dark, but what you're seeing there is the splice and the splicing block. Up here is the tape itself, and there's the glue, the residual glue of the tape after the splice literally just fell apart. Ah, yes, there it is, heptane and isopropyl alcohol. Forget about the contact clean. I just put that in the picture as one of another thing to use, but that's usually for electronic equipment. And as a result, this is the clean splice, still with the splicing tape, just to show you after it's been cleaned. And then the new splicing tape put on it. The time we use Scotch 620, which is a Mylar-based.
What's the mix of the two fluids?
Generally, what I do is I wet it, swab a cotton swab with a certain amount of heptane, wipe it clean, then use the alcohol to do a clean wipe.
Oh, okay.
In other words, to get off the pick up the residual glue that has been loosened.
In the old days, would you have used Freon, or would you still have used this?
This is something that the RCA engineers used from the day they started splicing tape. This is where I found it out in 19.
The brand that ever worked, the lighting fluid.
Right, the lighter fluid. Because I saw it in all the studios when I went there, and I asked the engineer. He said, the guys who were here in the 50s were using this. And they were working on much harder stuff. We're only working here with 7.5 IPS tapes. They're dealing with 30 IPRs.
I just want to let you know, used bulk heptane bought from chemical supply houses, and it seems to work just as well as Ronson lighter fluid. But being a smoker, of course, I'm always happy to see anything that continues to support the satellite industries. And now for the recorded examples, which come from two recordings of the Minneapolis Symphony Orchestra conducted by Antal Dorat. The first is of his own cello concerto and was recorded in December of 1957 with Robert Jameson as soloist. The swishy or phasey quality I mentioned earlier can be clearly heard here. The source was a 7.5 inches per second copy of a now lost 15 inches per second master. And Seth will describe these examples in a little greater detail.
Okay, what we're going to hear is a playback of this full track tape, which had been left fast wound since probably 1957 to 58, with a two track stereo playback head in stereo. Track one, please. You can hear how it kept bouncing between the two channels. This is what happens when you're trying to play back a tape that's badly deformed and you're using that kind of area where it's not making proper head contact because of the twisting, the torsional twisting of the tape as it goes by the playback head. Now, of course, you can't put it out that way. We have to put it back into mono. It's a mono recording. Could we have track two, please?
familiar? You must have heard this on some wonderful reissues on CD. I think if I remember correctly, there was a Mercury from Japan. The pictures had an exhibition with Kubelik in Chicago that kind of sounded like that. I remember hearing something like that. Pardon me?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, all the early Toscanini CDs were like that.
Yeah, well, that's part of the problem. Was a dubbing. I keep hitting the podium here, I'm sorry. A dubbing like that.
Yeah.
Or using a two-channel, stereo playback, and then trying to sum it back into mono. Okay. Can we have track three? This is the, just a moment, track three, I'm sorry. This is the same tape with the quad head using the two center channels in stereo. Playing and now summed into mono.
Our second example is there are two examples from the last pages of the slow movement of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, recorded in April 1953. The source here is a 15 inches per second tape with edge damage. The effect is far subtler than the previous example, but when I heard the difference between the two playbacks, I was struck by how the quarter track playback pulled into sharp focus what was vague in the two track.
Alrighty, well, this is a section from the third movement. It's a little more subtle because you have to remember now we're dealing with a tape that's riding at a much faster speed. So there's less chance of major, if there is deformation, it's going by a lot quicker, therefore making slightly better head contact, but not perfect. Can we have the next track, please? This is in stereo, two-track playback. Continue. I must also say something else. Every one of these tapes I put up and did as best a phase correction I could do, alignment, manually with it, with the scope, and sometimes not even with the scope. You'd be surprised how many engineers, when they deal with tapes, I had one engineer I was working with, I threw the alignment tape up, then put up the tape, and I ran it. And I went, One of the tricks,
And it was, believe me, you have to find certain retrofitted pieces. I have a preamp I use, a Bryston. And why did I buy a Bryston? Because it has what's called a mono switch. Remember those folks? Ah, they're long gone. It's very important to flip the system into mono when you're playing back a stereo tape, and then you adjust it to what I call the sweet spot, where you get the cleanest playback of the tape. And maybe you have to lock in sometimes to the surface noise, sometimes to the applause. And when you hear that spot, you've got it as best aligned manually. See, this is the trick with everything we work on, as with the films. 90% of your trick is getting a clean analog playback, whether it's from a disc, tape, or film. Otherwise, remember the old saying about computers, garbage in equals garbage out.
All mechanical,
as best a mechanical correction and analog correction you can do before it goes in, because certain problems cannot be attained. For example, the Jameson Dorati concerto, that first two-track playback where I summed it just into mono, running it through the Cedar phase corrector, I got the same result because of the amount of edge curl damage in there that it just could not, there wasn't enough information for it to lock into phase properly. Can we have the next track? This is the two-track now summed to mono, and you'll hear what happens. We lost a high end and kind of like a... Alrighty. Now, toward the end of the movement, here we go again. Here's the two-track playback at the very end of the movement in stereo. That was the four-track playback in stereo. Now let's have the next track, which is the four-track head pan to mono.
Examples are going to be from the very end of the movement and have a little different take to give you some different textures, but also some interesting tape damage at the very end and how we got around it.
Okay, this is now two-track stereo playback in stereo, and what you, well, let's play it and I'll explain what happens.
Thank you.
Okay, now let's hear the same excerpt, pan to mono, from the two-track stereo playback. Also hear a kind of a blip blip on those two woodwind notes. Well, when they made the dub, the tape had a splice in it. It got caught in the transport. That's what's commonly caused as a little bit of a twang. Let me play now the four-track stereo play back of it using the four-track head, and then some to mono. I'll explain to you what we were, how we were able to fix that problem at the end. Okay, next track, please. Notice what Dennis was talking about, that bump at the end is a little more pronounced now because of the difference of the head alignment, the head size in playback. Now to the next track, this is it panned to mono.
Now here we are with a better capture of the audio on the tape, but we still have this damned glitch at the end.
So what do we do? Well, you remember the film examples we just heard, where they cleaned everything up, but there was still a residual thump in the last example he gave? Well, Sadie has a wonderful module that Cedar came up called the dethumper. We were able to get out that thump where the splice was, as well as a lot of little bias noises that also creep into these tapes, little thumps, blumps, blumps that go by. It's also terrific in taking out gas bubble noises and 78 RPM transfers. In fact, I remember Dennis and I sat there on the opening clarinet solo to the Romanian Rhapsody with Ormandy in Minneapolis from a Victor 78. Now, mind you, we're only talking maybe the first 20 or 30 seconds, spending about 2 hours on it, removing little, besides what Cedar would take out of the crackle and transient noise, the little gas bubbles that were left, the thumps and little ticks or little noises that were in the master. So, like the saying goes, garbage in equals garbage out. But if you can get something in that's as clean as possible, and you can work with that, you've got something.
All right, so fine, we fixed that thump. It takes it out beautifully, but we've got a problem because of that bump, and especially what happens with anything with sustained winds, horn, or piano tones, is that it still's got this bump in here. So what did Dennis and I do? Well, we sat there for about 2 hours, and Dennis, with the score, said, okay, we're gonna do a little bit of cloning and a little bit of magic with those last three notes. Could we have the next track, please? And this is what's gonna be on the CD. Right, but that's all you have to work with.
The manner of speaking at that time, yes. And those of you who thought you heard flutter in the earlier excerpt, that wasn't flutter, that was just the extraordinary fast German vibrato of the principal horn, Waldemar Linder. So, send in the clones. That's my philosophy. And I want to add that all of the earlier discussion pertaining to tape track width and gap error is equally applicable to the individual tracks of a stereo or multi-track recording, with the added error possibilities of time displacements between or among the tracks. In fact, in analog multi-track recorders, the stability of time or phase relationships between distantly separated tracks was never really solved at all. Just one more reason why tape is the devil. But in order to work with our enemy and defeat him, we must know him. So, thank you very much for your attention, and thank you, Seth. And thank you, Barbara, for the wonderful job of playing those examples.
We got questions.
We welcome questions from the floor, including those of Mr. Beal.
Yeah, but this way you can get a much more you can do a correct azimuth correcting as if you're doing a stereo dub of it, and then you run it through a digital phase corrector, and then you get an absolutely perfect playback.
But that, of course, if
too many people lose, and
then you can go on.
That's his question. That's all we got.
Yeah, but you're using more of a playback gap with two heads rather than one to get a better signal to noise ratio.
Yeah, but if you can get
But do you hear the difference of the results we got here? That's the whole point of it. No, it's to try to use as much of a playback gap as possible within the parameters of a full track tape that is deformed.
Yeah.